On February 4th, The Minds of Madness is set to release an investigative four-part series centered on a cold case from nearly four decades ago.
At first, it was just, my mom's gone. And then it became, you know, your mom was taken by a bad man.
They found video of him killing women.
If you'd ever watched any episodes of Breaking Bad, that's exactly what you would see.
He buried these 11 women and kept going out there. He made a road going out there.
You got this dude saying, hey, I'm going to show your family these pictures. And, like, he's secretly taping her.
The cops don't care. We're nothing to them.
They dumped her like a piece of garbage, you know?
I don't see anything that screams there's two people doing this.
I never thought anything was going to come of this case. Ever.
Listen to the Minds of Madness series, Who Killed Jennifer, starting February 4th, wherever you get your podcasts.
It was raining heavily during that night. Yes, she in fact was seen walking from the bus with an umbrella, a shoulder bag. You would think there were a lot of people around, albeit it was raining heavily. So yeah, no, it is. It's shocking.
Nestled along the Brisbane River in Australia, Kurilpa Park emerges as a hidden gem in the Australian urban landscape. The small oasis boasts winding footpaths and cycle trails beneath the William Jolly and Kurilpa bridges, creating a tranquil retreat for those seeking respite from the city buzz. A mere stroll from the park leads to the Gallery of Modern Art and the heart of the city's central business district, making Kurilpa Park a convenient gateway to cultural and urban adventures. The Green Haven features a lone gas barbecue, a sprinkling of poinsettias, and a picnic shelter, providing a modest yet charming spot for relaxation. Since it's surrounded by several bridges, the park shares its space with diverse homeless communities. In close proximity, a Catholic Auscare hostel caters to homeless men and individuals recently paroled from prison for various crimes, even including murder and rape. The three-level brick building offers a refuge for men with nowhere else to go, and is set back from a busy Peel Street corner, just next to St. Mary's Catholic Church. In addition to being a hostel, the building houses a busy parole program and serves as a temporary home for some of society's most damaged and dangerous men. As one officer commented, "Murderers, rapists and paedophiles get paroled to Auscare, and not many people know about it." While the park, which is adorned with CCTV surveillance, welcomes the public during daylight, it undergoes a subtle transformation as night falls. Since Auscare has a 9 p.m. curfew, on most nights there are a handful of men that miss that curfew and are forced to sleep outside. At night, the benches in Kurilpa Park become resting grounds for the drunk and homeless, casting an air of unease for women navigating its paths after dark. Around 10,000 miles away from Brisbane is the quaint village of St. Julien Mondeny in the French Alps. The village is embraced by alpine scenery and boasts stunning views of snow-capped peaks, valleys and meadows. The small village was where Sophie Colombet was born to parents, Corinne and Guy, in the year of 1993. Sophie was the youngest of three siblings, with two older brothers, Lionel and Guillaume, and their familial bonds were strong. Sophie was driven to explore the world and learn languages on the go, which prompted her to embark on her journey early on. After visiting Denmark and Germany, in February of 2013, Sophie and her boyfriend Boris Foster set their sights on Brisbane, Australia. Their intention was not merely to travel, but to live and study in a country boasting a $14 billion-plus overseas education industry, with around 500,000 international students. Choosing Brisbane, the third most popular destination for international students after Sydney and Melbourne, the couple settled into an apartment close to Griffith University. Sophie was enthusiastic about her educational pursuit, and she enrolled in a master's degree in international business, quickly making friends. Among them was Nahad Hussein from Iraq, who described her as a very smart woman who was always at the top of the class. Sophie was known for her vibrant and friendly personality, and she always made sure to chat with the strangers at the bus stop as she travelled to and from school. They always remembered her for her French accent. Adjusting to her new life in Australia, Sophie ensured regular contact with her family through Skype every Sunday, and she always expressed her love for Australia. However, in May of 2014, Boris's visa expired, and he had to return to France alone. While Sophie initially hesitated to stay in Australia by herself, the limited time left in her final year at university prompted her to continue her studies. To support herself, she took on various odd jobs, such as private French tutoring, cleaning, and waitressing in local cafes. With Boris back in France, Sophie moved in to view apartments on the CBD fringe, sharing this space with other young individuals, including Takeshi Furukawa, who came from Brisbane from Japan. Sophie and Takeshi formed an instant connection, navigating the cultural nuances with an effortless friendship that transcended borders. On the night of the 27th of March 2014, a storm swept through the city of Brisbane, prompting its residents to seek refuge from the relentless downpour. The city was unnaturally quiet, but in the early morning hours the heavy rain began to dissipate, and Kurilpa Park returned to its normal hum of life. The homeless population emerged from their makeshift shelters underneath bridges and various hideouts, and made their way to the familiar park. Some of them noticed a homeless woman lying on a bench within the band rotunda, in a state of vulnerability. She was cloaked from chest to thigh with pieces of newspaper, seemingly braving the elements in an effort to stay warm and sheltered. Such sights were unfortunately not uncommon in a park that often served as a refuge for those facing the harsh realities of life. At about 6 a.m, a homeless man approached the rotunda, hoping to claim a spot on the bench. However, the stillness of the woman asleep on the bench caught his attention. Upon closer inspection, he could see that she was completely motionless. Concerned, the man made a futile attempt to awaken her, but the woman wouldn't rouse. It was in this moment that he noticed that there was blood matted in her hair. The man then frantically shook the woman and felt for a pulse, only to discover that the woman was dead. The man immediately made contact with police, who arrived in a matter of minutes and cordoned off the area. The young woman was officially pronounced dead at the scene, and her body was then transported to the medical examiner's office. The pathologist found that a single, devastating blow to her head had fractured her skull, eventually causing her death. However, this wasn't the only horror that the young woman had sustained. She had been brutally assaulted, leaving her with black eyes, bruises across her hands, feet, and elbows. Before being killed, the young woman had also been raped. The medical examiner reconstructed the sequence of events, surmising that the woman had been attacked, dragged across the ground, repeatedly struck on the head, and then raped. Following this, she was carefully arranged on the bench and covered with newspapers, in an effort to conceal the crime. The pathologist determined that the young woman had remained alive for several hours after the assault. Her vulnerable state had been dismissed by passers-by, who mistook her for a sleeping homeless person. Naked except for some jewellery, the victim carried no form of identification. Fingerprints yielded no matches in the national database, leading detectives in a quest to identify her. Turning to social media, detectives posted a photograph of the distinctive jewellery that she was wearing. Meanwhile, thousands of miles away in France, Boris grew increasingly uneasy about the unexplained silence from his girlfriend, Sophie Colombet. As he signed into social media that evening, he saw the Brisbane police appeal online and recognised the jewellery immediately as belonging to Sophie. After hearing from Boris, who provided detectives with a photograph of Sophie, the woman on the bench in the park was formally identified as Sophie Colombet. The inquiry into her murder swiftly commenced, with detectives eager to retrace her final movements. Are you still grappling with stress and struggling to maintain focus, despite making it a New Year's resolution? Truvaga offers a solution. This handheld device stimulates the vagus nerve, enhancing overall health and wellness. By stimulating the vagus nerve, Truvaga helps rebalance and strengthen the nervous system, leading to reduced stress, improved focus, enhanced mood, and better sleep. With customizable sessions lasting just 2 minutes each, incorporating one in the morning and one at night is easily achievable. Truvaga provides 355 sessions, enough for approximately 6 months of twice-daily use. It's entirely drug-free, and it's straightforward to use, requiring no app or phone. Experience the benefits of improved health with Truvaga. It's a win-win situation. Visit truvaga.com, which is spelled truvaga.com, and enter the promo code Morbidology to enhance your wellness journey. Support this podcast and receive $15 off. That is truvaga.com. Check out promo code Morbidology. Her roommate Takashi told detectives he had last seen her on Thursday morning, the day before her body was discovered in the park. Takashi had been returning home from the night shift when he encountered Sophie smoking on the balcony. They exchanged morning greetings before he retired to bed while Sophie got ready for a busy day ahead at university. Detectives initiated a thorough examination of local CCTV footage, revealing Sophie leaving her apartment at around 8:30 a.m. on the 27th of March. She traversed Go Between Bridge, a multi-use toll bridge connecting South Brisbane to the Milton area, en route to Griffith University for a full day of classes. Sophie safely reached the university and attended classes that extended until 8:30 p.m. Leaving the campus with a friend, they found themselves caught in a downpour, prompting them to share an umbrella. Despite her friend's offer of a lift, Sophie declined, opting to catch the bus in the heavy rain. The streets were emptier than usual that night due to people seeking refuge from the downpour. The bus dropped Sophie off at South Bank Cultural Forecourt on Melbourne Street. From here, she walked towards Kurilpa Bridge, through Kurilpa Park, passing landmarks such as Queensland Art Gallery, the State Library of Queensland, and the Gallery of Modern Art. By around 9 p.m, Sophie would have reached the Riverside Boardwalk, typically vibrant but that night, unusually hushed amid the rain-soaked city. Her route would have continued across Kurilpa Bridge, leading her to her apartment. Her route would have continued across Kurilpa Bridge, leading her to her apartment on Key Street, just on the edge of the CBD. A journey that was familiar to Sophie. The boardwalk was considered open and secure, at least compared to the alternative routes through industrial backstreets or isolated paths, so it was a preferred choice for her. Typically, however, somewhere along this well-trodden path, Sophie crossed paths with her killer. Unfortunately, there was no CCTV coverage along this particular route, leaving detectives with a challenging gap in surveillance. Captured on CCTV, Sophie appeared in long, dark pants, black ankle boots, a sleeveless knitted beige shirt, and carried a white shoulder bag containing essentials such as her iPad, a BlackBerry phone, and her purse. An umbrella shielded her from the elements. However, when Sophie's body was discovered, these personal items were noticeably absent. Detectives appealed to the public to be vigilant, urging anyone who may have seen Sophie on the night of her murder to come forward, or if they saw her belongings anywhere. In an effort to unearth clues, police divers navigated through the nearby river, discovering a black umbrella roughly 1 kilometre away from the crime scene. However, they weren't exactly sure whether it belonged to Sophie or not. The search expanded, with detectives meticulously combing through the park, inspecting bins and bushes, yet Sophie's possessions remained elusive. As days passed without a breakthrough, detectives grew increasingly concerned that the killer could strike again. It was apparent to detectives that Sophie was attacked as she walked home alone in the night, raising the possibility that the killer was an opportunistic one. The heavy rain that night had made the area more desolate than usual, meaning that there was likely no witnesses, hampered visibility, and it was possible that the sound of heavy rain had drowned out Sophie screaming for help. Because of the seemingly random and brutal nature of the murder, it seemed likely to detectives that the killer could be on the search for another victim. As Detective Inspector Rod Kemp said, "Anyone who could do this kind of thing is obviously an extreme threat."
It was raining heavily during that night. Yes, she in fact was seen walking from the bus with an umbrella, a shoulder bag. You would think there were a lot of people around, albeit it was raining heavily. So yeah, no, it is. It's shocking. I don't think there's anything to suggest you could put a tag of a foreign student on. I think she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Some rumours began circulating that Sophie was targeted because she was a foreign student. But detectives said that there was no evidence to suggest this. They noted that Sophie spoke good English, and she dressed like a local. The murder weapon and Sophie's clothing still hadn't been found, so detectives set up a post at the Riverside Park where she was found. Over the course of the next 12 hours, they interviewed every single person who came into the park and asked whether they had seen anybody or anything suspicious that night. As detectives continued in their investigation, Detective Kemp stressed that while the murder was horrific, he still believed that Brisbane was a safe place. This was echoed by State Premier Campbell Newman, who stated, "I believe it is safe not only for students, but safe for Brisbane residents." Did you know that 2/3 of Americans are at risk of experiencing a blackout? The thought of being left in the dark, cold, and powerless for hours, if not days or weeks, is downright terrifying. But fear not. Four Patriots is the ultimate solution to keep you and your loved ones safe and comfortable during emergencies. The Patriot Power Solar Generator 2000X. This powerhouse of a solar generator has been hailed by many as worth its weight in gold. And why wouldn't it be? With double the capacity and expandability, you can keep essential appliances running longer, from your fridge to your electric blanket, RV air conditioner, or electric wheelchair. Equipped with 12 outlets, including 4 AC outlets and 2 USB-C ports, you can power up multiple devices simultaneously. Plus, it's completely fume-free, making it safe for indoor use, and it never requires gas. don't wait for the next blackout to hit. Head on over to fourpatriots.com/morbidology now to secure your Patriot Power Solar Generator 2000X and receive a free solar panel with your purchase. Prepare for peace of mind and uninterrupted power supply today. Sophie was actually the fourth international student to be murdered in Brisbane in recent months, but detectives stressed that there was no link between them. Around a month earlier, Singapore student Mentachi Narayanan was stabbed to death in a hotel room on Brisbane's south side. Her 31-year-old boyfriend was charged with her murder. Then in November the year before, Korean youth exchange participant Angie Bam was dragged into the city's Central Parklands while walking to her cleaning job and killed. A 19-year-old man named Alex McEwen had been charged with her murder. Then in December, South Korean student Min Tae Kim was discovered dead in a shallow grave. He had been killed by a man named Sang Hyung Wang after posting on Gumtree seeking somebody who could give him a good exchange rate to send money back home. Sophie's family opted out of flying over from France, saying that their grief was still too raw to see where their daughter had been killed. However, her brother, Guillaume, posted a tribute on social media, writing, "In every corner of the sky, in every drop of water, in each iceberg, in each lake or river, in each flower, the blue of your eyes will still be with us." Detectives continued scouring through CCTV footage from various buildings in the area to see if they could identify a person of interest. Thus far, not a single piece of evidence was found that could point them in the direction of Sophie's killer. As they searched through the hours of footage, they found grainy images of a man near the murder scene, both before and after it took place. He was around 180 centimetres tall, with fair hair and hazel eyes, and he was dressed in a black singlet with long dark pants. He was seen in the park where Sophie was killed, yet he hadn't come forward despite numerous appeals. Intrigued by the possibility that he might have witnessed something crucial that night, detectives embarked on a mission to identify and locate this man. As they searched for the unidentified man, they attempted to retrace his movements that night. Further CCTV footage captured the man taking a train from South Brisbane Station to Bowen Hill Station at 11:23 p.m. after Sophie was killed. From here, he was last seen heading towards Abbotsford Road. Detectives turned their attention once more to Kurilpa Park, specifically the transient men who often hung out there. They spoke to one man who said he had been drinking at the rotunda where Sophie's body was found earlier in the night before she was killed. He said that he was in the company of a man named Ben, who lived in the Oscare hostel, just a stone's throw away from the park. Detectives made their way over to the hostel, armed with the information they had gathered thus far. According to staff, the man in the footage looked exactly like 25-year-old Benjamin James Millward. They said that he had been staying with them for the past couple of weeks, but had since seemingly disappeared. The last time that he was seen was the night that Sophie was killed, and he had apparently left in a hurry, leaving behind all of his clothing and possessions. Detectives now had a name, but despite their best efforts to track Millward down, they couldn't find him. On the 4th of April, detectives announced to the public that they were searching for Millward.
Is he a suspect?
We don't know his involvement in the matter at this stage. As I say, whether he's a witness or has some further involvement, we're not sure at this point in time what his actual involvement is.
Speaking just for the record, can you spell his name out for us?
Yes, it's Benjamin. Normal spelling of Benjamin, James Millward, M-I-L-W-A-R-D. As I said, he's 25 years of age. He is known to frequent the South Bank Kurilpa area, and his current whereabouts are unknown to police.
Is he a homeless person, or how would you describe his status in the community?
Our understanding is he isn't a homeless person, I wouldn't say at this stage. Certainly itinerant, and as I said, at the moment we don't know of a fixed place of abode for this person.
They released a photograph of him, along with the description, mentioning a dragon tattoo that he had across the left side of his chest. At the time of Sophie's murder, Millward was homeless and was known to frequent Kilrupa Park. He had worked for 9 years in hospitality and as a labourer, but for the past year or so, he had struggled with drug addiction and alcohol dependency. In the weeks leading up to Sophie's murder, Millward had been living in Oscare Hostel, and he was already well known to police. Having been released from prison in December of 2012 after serving time for a severe assault, he found himself back behind bars due to a parole violation. He was released once more in July of 2013. Millward's criminal record included convictions for various offences, such as theft and causing public disturbances, reflecting a pattern of involvement in drugs and robbery. As the search for Millward continued, detectives made contact with other people living in the men's hostel. They spoke with a man named Lane Smith, who had crossed paths with Millward while living at the hostel. He told detectives that in the hours before Sophie was killed, Millward was high and drunk. He said that in the morning, he and Millward went to the apartment of David Nelson, a mutual acquaintance, where Millward injected a shot of crystal methamphetamine. After injecting the drug, Millward told Lane that he hadn't taken it in a long time, but when he had used it in the past, it had caused him a problem. However, Millward didn't elaborate on what this problem was. Sometime later, the two men left and went to a nearby hotel where Millward drank beer and played table tennis. From here, the two men returned to David's home, where the three of them shared a 750ml bottle of Jim Beam and two bottles of wine. Then sometime after 5 p.m, Millward made his way to Kurilpa Park, where he bumped into another hostel resident, Justin Christopher Wood. According to Justin, they sat on the rotunda for a while, where Millward injected some more crystal methamphetamine. Justin said that he returned to the hostel, leaving Millward at the park alone. According to Lane, he didn't see Millward again until around 11 p.m, when he appeared outside the hostel in an energetic demeanour. It was pouring with rain, but Millward was only wearing a singlet and cargo pants. He couldn't get into the hostel for the night because it had a 9 p.m. lockout. Lane told Millward that he would go to another hostel to get him some warm clothing, but when he returned, Millward was gone. Despite Millward's troubled past and potential involvement in Sophie's murder, once he was identified in the media, several people who knew him came to his defence. Kiria Goodsell, who had known him for years, commented, "Coming from someone who has spent time with him and had sleepovers, he just wouldn't come across as a guy who would hurt anyone. I've seen him in fights. He was always the one to walk away." Detectives urged the public to reach out immediately if they had seen Millward and told them not to approach him if he was spotted. Detective Kemp announced, "He was believed to have been at the scene around the time we believe Sophie was killed. We ask people if they know this person not to approach him." However, Detective Kemp stressed that Millward wasn't a suspect in Sophie's murder, just a person of interest, possibly even a witness to the murder. But the days continued to pass and Millward failed to surface, adding to the cloud of suspicion he was already under. Detectives thought that if he were innocent, he would have handed himself in. They spoke with Millward's family, who said that they hadn't seen or heard from him since the night Sophie was killed. In an effort to trace him, his family made pleas across social media for him to hand himself in, so that he could be ruled out of the investigation if he were indeed innocent. His cousin, Mel Millward Tyrrell, posted on Facebook, "If anyone has seen my beloved cousin Benny, please contact the police. Love you, Benny. Everything's going to be okay." His aunt, Tara Douglas, also appealed to him on Network 10, stating, "We're not going to let you be out there by yourself, but you haven't been found guilty of anything yet, Ben, and we need to sort that out." His mother, Diane, also begged him to hand himself in, and asked him to call and sort it out for the sake of Sophie's family. She said what most of the community was already thinking. The longer it goes on, the more people are starting to believe he must have done it. As the search for Millward continued, a makeshift memorial began to take shape at the rotunda where Sophie's body was discovered. People from all across the city left behind flowers and cards of condolences. One particularly poignant one read, "I'm sorry your life was lost in our city. I hope you're at peace now." Meanwhile, women in the area began to speak publicly about the dangers along the Riverside Boardwalk where Sophie was attacked. A woman who lived in the same apartment complex as Sophie wrote to the Courier Mail about how the area was often swarming with drunk men and homeless people. She wrote, "This happens day and night where Sophie was. I have never seen any police or security of any kind in that area." According to the woman, she had been accosted and yelled at by men as she walked home during the day. She spoke about one particularly frightening experience as she walked along the route at night, writing, "I constantly checked to see if I was being followed, and actually ran over the bridge home." Griffith University Women's Association announced that they were planning a vigil in Sophie's honour. Spokeswoman Stephanie Kamerick stated, "It was something important to organise, to stand together to mourn her life and stand up against violence against women." We all love our pets, right? That's why their health is one of our top priorities. Well, did you know the benefits of CBD for your pets? Research shows it can alleviate pain, inflammation, and anxiety in animals, and can even help in reducing seizures and stimulate appetite. That's where Hemp My Pet, one of the first CBD companies for pets, comes in. Hemp My Pet grows their own hemp, processes it, and then formulates the products. They've had two clinical trials, including one that showed 90% of dogs saw a massive reduction in pain, and another which showed a reduction in the cortisol levels of horses during transportation, hence reducing their stress. All of their products are human grade, and they're made with the best organic ingredients. Just head on over to hempmypet.com and use the promo code Morbidology to get 20% off your order. As the search for Millward pressed on, Detectives Lindsay Schubert and Stephen Voigt were heading along Harbour Drive at Coffs Harbour, around 400 kilometres away from Brisbane. It was around 3 p.m. on the 8th of April when they spotted a man in the distance that looked eerily familiar. As they drew closer, they could see that it was Benjamin Millward. They approached the man and asked, "Are you Ben?" Expecting the man to deny that he was, they were surprised when he responded, Yeah, you got me. Was it the internet?" Millward was arrested and transported to jail, while Queensland police applied to have him extradited, an application that was immediately approved. Millward's DNA and fingerprints were taken, and his DNA came back as a match to the DNA that was found underneath Sophie's fingernails. It was found to be 1.1 million times more likely to have come from Millward than anybody else. The next day, Millward appeared in a packed Brisbane courtroom where he was charged with murder, rape, deprivation of liberty, and robbery. Magistrate Anne Thacker adjourned his case until the 19th of May. Outside of court, his defense attorney, Michael Bosher, spoke on behalf of his family, telling the community. He's distressed, given the circumstances he finds himself in, but otherwise, in relatively good health and spirits. The day after Millward was charged, a gathering of hundreds assembled to march through Brisbane towards the park where Sophie was killed. The haunting melody of bagpipes wafted over the Brisbane River, resonating from the impromptu memorial, which was now graced with a French flag, and photographs of Sophie. At the memorial site, Rosalind Trott, a family friend, delivered a eulogy crafted by Sophie's family. With a visible struggle to contain her emotions, Rosalind expressed, "O little one, you feared nothing. Be you our daughter, our sister, our love or our friend, you exist in every blink of the eye, in every flower, in every break of dawn." Renee Harper, a local resident, shared that she had traversed the same path as Sophie that same night. Addressing the crowd, she urged the community to stand united against violence, asserting, "We don't want the animals to win." On the 17th of April, Sophie was laid to rest in her hometown. Over 1,200 villagers turned out to bid her one final farewell. It was the most substantial funeral procession since the passing of a reverend mayor 7 years prior in the tranquil village of St. Julian Mont-Denis. Meanwhile, back in Brisbane, community concern manifested in the form of a petition directed at the Brisbane City Council, urging various alterations to the park where Sophie was killed. A focal point of the proposed changes involved relocating the rotunda, now transformed into a shrine for Sophie closer to the main pathway. The rationale behind this plea was rooted in the fact that the current position was obscured from the cyclist pathway, prompting safety concerns within the community. Responding to these collective voices, a decision was reached to establish a lasting memorial for Sophie beneath the sheltering branches of a fig tree within the park. Crafted by her family, the memorial stone featured a scenic representation of the French mountain town she hailed from, accompanied by the image of a butterfly. In a touching anecdote, Sophie's brother, William, shared that a few days after her murder, he encountered a butterfly. Seeking solace, he extended his hand, and to his amazement, the butterfly landed and remained there for several minutes. This moment inspired the design of the memorial, creating a lasting tribute to Sophie's memory in the heart of the park she once frequented. Then in July of 2015, Millward appeared in court for his committal hearing. His two old friends, Leon and Justin, testified about him drinking and injecting crystal methamphetamine the day that Sophie was killed. According to the prosecution, when Millward appeared outside the hostel later that night in an energetic mood, it was because he had just brutally raped and attacked Sophie. As the hearing winded down, Millward rose from his seat and addressed Lane and Justin, telling them, "I'm sorry for putting you in this situation." The judge ultimately ruled that there was enough evidence against Millward to have him stand trial for Sophie's murder. On the 11th of October 2016, Millward appeared in court where he pleaded guilty to the rape and murder of Sophie. Sophie's brother was sitting in the public gallery to face Millward for the very first time. Following the court proceedings, her brother shared that the rest of the family would be flying in from France to witness the sentencing, which was scheduled for later in the month. Amidst this emotional context, Millward's mother, Diane, offered her perspective. Expressing a complex mix of emotions, she conveyed her son's remorse while adding a surprising note of pride in his acknowledgement of guilt, stating, "I'm actually quite proud that he has owned up to it, and he's not trying to fight it or deny it." Diane went on to attribute her son's actions that night to the influence of drugs, asserting her belief that they were to blame for his behaviour. Millward returned to court on the 26th of October, where more details of the case were presented. after brutally attacking and raping Sophie, Millward had told her that he was going to get her help. He left her on the bench and covered her with newspapers. Instead, however, he threw her possessions into the river and then fled from the state, leaving her to slowly die alone. Millward accepted what he had done, but he couldn't say exactly why he had done it, other than to blame the crystal meth amphetamine. During his interview with detectives, he had said, "What I've done is just fucking horrible. I didn't intend for nothing to happen," before admitting that he was a bit of a sex addict. Sophie's family had flown over from France to provide victim impact statements. Her two brothers read a collective statement describing their endless grief. "We have lost sleep, the enjoyment of life, and the desire to move forward. We are in a state of physical and moral exhaustion." They said that the entire family felt constant pain because there was always something that reminded them of Sophie. Her mother, Corinne, said that she had no motivation to make any plans for the future, while her father, Guy, said that nothing could fill the void his daughter's murder had created. Sophie's boyfriend, Boris, tearfully said, "All my nights are haunted by memory and nightmares. Sophie and I had plans for the future. We set dreams." Justice Anne Lyons condemned Millward's cowardly attack, telling him, "Nothing can ever diminish the enormity of your appalling actions on that night." She continued, telling him,
"To your credit, you admitted when you were arrested that you had been in the park consuming ice on the night. You admitted to police that what you had done was horrible. You admitted to using ice and speed for the previous 3 years. You had been staying in a nearby homeless person's hostel. You had consumed both alcohol and drugs on the day and had obtained about 3 points of ice during the day. You recalled shooting up a couple of points around lunchtime and then having some more after you purchased it later in the day. You told police you could recall sexually assaulting a young woman around 9 o'clock. You had covered her with a jumper, and when you left, she was alive. You admitted you threw her possessions in the river and left her for dead. You also disposed of your phone and clothing. Your fingerprints and DNA were found at the scene. You abandoned a severely injured woman. Your actions simply defy belief."
She then sentenced Millward to life in prison with a minimum of 20 years for her murder. For the rape, he was given a 15-year sentence that was to be served concurrently. In handing down the sentence, the judge said,
"You allowed your sexual desires to overwhelm you. You focused solely on your interests. You had no regard for Miss Colombay. Your actions were cowardly. You attacked a woman alone in a park. You were affected by ice and you had been drinking. That is no excuse. You chose to take those substances."
As Millward was escorted out of the courtroom to begin serving his sentence, he glanced over towards Sophie's family and quietly said, "I'm so sorry." Sophie Colombay had travelled from her hometown in France to Brisbane in Australia with the purpose of bettering her future. She was just 1 month shy of completing her master's degree and had ambitions to return to France to be with her boyfriend and family. In her eyes, Brisbane was meant to be a city of opportunity and safety. But on the last night of her life, her path intersected with that of Benjamin Millward, a transient man spiralling down a dark trajectory. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Kathy. You can join Morbidology on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes, behind the scenes, and I also send out a thank you note along with some exclusive merch. Patreon really helps independent shows continue, and as a one-woman show, I genuinely do appreciate the support. I've just finished up writing my next true crime book, and I'll give you guys more details when that's available to pre-order. If you haven't had the chance to pick up a copy of my latest true crime book, Killers Caught, that came out last year, then please do check it out. It's available on Amazon and in all good bookstores, as well as some supermarkets including Walmart and Target. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Ratings and reviews are a super easy way to support a show that you like, and I genuinely do appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read some true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.